From ancient times, men and women have embraced sacred music, different forms of prayer, religious vestments full of symbolism, gestures and rituals to express their innermost feelings of devotion to God. The variety of these forms of expression is as wide and diverse as the human family, yet all have the same ultimate purpose: to connect the believer with the object of their devotion in the most personal way, to draw close to God.
Physically no good. I have a heart that's made of wood, and I am only biding time, only reciting memorized lines. And I'm not fit to touch the hem of your garment. No, no, I'm not fit to touch the hem of your garment.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Hey, hobo man. Hey, Dapper Dan. You've both got your style, but brother, you're never fully dressed without a smile.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and recently the LDS Church released a short 5-minute video to show the world how, you know, garments and temple clothes aren't really weird. No, they're just like every other kind of religious vestment that religious people have used since back in the olden days.
From ancient times.
Yeah, that's what I said. So anyway, today we're going to talk about it. So you'll be hearing from myself, Matt, Chelsea, Nick, and if you listen with super faithful ears, maybe even a special confirming message or two from Holy the Ghost himself.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah, he's still around. All right, so kids, do you want everyone to listen?
Yeah! Yeah. Everyone listen!
Yeah. I don't know how to start talking about this garment one. You know, the very first line in this video is from ancient times. And I think there's some significance. Like, there's a reason that it starts with that. And so, like, I just wanted to ask you guys, what does that evoke? Like, if you put on your TBM Whisperer hats or something, if you could do that, what, like, if you're a member and you hear from ancient times, like, what does that evoke?
Well, biblical times, from, like, yeah, like biblical or Old Testament. I think that's what you hear. That's what you think when you're a member and you hear that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what immediately jumps to my mind. It's the oft-repeated myth that the temple ceremony comes from antiquity and Solomon's temple, right?
Yeah.
It almost seemed like a code word of a coded way of evoking that emotion.
Yeah. What do you think, Chelsea?
Well, to me, it seemed really fascinating because the church is so recent. So they're like seeing the images that they had on the video, right? They're showing monks, they're showing Jewish sacraments, they're showing different types of vestments in these old traditions. And they're saying, see, garments are just like these. And yet if we really look at the timelines, they're nothing like these traditions, right? They're so recent. Nothing that they showed in that from ancient times in the like very, very awesome voice. Nothing else they showed was even close to the time period that Mormon garments are. And I think that's fascinating. I mean, I think it says a lot about the message they want to convey, which is, look, we're just like everyone else. We have these long-standing traditions. We come from these, you know, these rituals. that cannot, you know, the beginning cannot be named? Do we know the beginning of a Jewish, you know, yarmulke? Not necessarily, or the Muslim veil. Do we know the exact origin and the exact template? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
But what about the Mormon garment? Well, yeah, we do.
Right. Yeah, you can trace
so
the origin.
So I think they were trying to build into this like old tradition, but it's kind of, you know, juxtapose, we seem enormously recent.
You just used Randy's second favorite word, juxtapose.
Juxtapose.
Yeah.
I thought it was enormously.
No. That too. The fact that they showed actual ceremonies, actual people doing actual things, and again juxtapose that with what was shown and what they were presenting, which is a little picture on a table, nice and pressed.
Oh yeah,
and that's it. But not the use of them, not the form of them,
not the female ones.
Right. So
not the female ones.
Yeah. So you mean they showed all these other religious rituals kind of in practice, in action, and then the Mormon shot was just very stale, just the garment sitting on them. But I want to go to this idea of ancient, and I think you I think you hit on like, Matt, that and what you said, Chelsea, trying to make something that's actually recent feel like it's ancient and it has this source from antiquity, and I think, you know, if you look at the idea of social evolution or cultural evolution, I think most people would agree that there's been progress from time. You know, I mean, there might be a little bit of regress here and there, but mainly it's progress, it's evolution. You know, from an anthropologic point of view, you could say going from a state of barbarianism to what is it? Is it primitive barbarian civilization?
Well, actually radically critique that kind of so what we would say from a actual evolutionary theory is it goes from a state of simplicity to a state of complexity.
Okay, so that's a nicer way of saying
things will get radically more exponentially more complex over time.
Sure.
Yeah.
But and I only want to state this because I think that Mormonism wants to flip that and say that we actually started off at a place where we were much more like God was closer, the commandments were more pure, and then there's been this process of de-evolution, devolving over time. Almost kind of like you see that in The Lord of the Rings with Tolkien, that like there were these great golden ages, and now all you have are these old survivals that you know, remind you of times of magic or, you know, something like that. But I think you have that in the LDS thought, and that the gospel that we have that is now the restored gospel isn't a recent creation, but it's an ancient restoration. And so you kind of have to have that model. So anyway, when I hear that first line from ancient times, it evokes all of that imagery and what they're trying to create and connecting something that's actually a recent creation. You can see where it was created. I think you mentioned that, Chelsea. But trying to obfuscate that a little bit, blur it.
Well, it's a form of, I'm not going to use this correctly, but a concept applied differently, like a pseudepigrapha, right? So it's taking something new and attaching it to something legitimate and old, and that's what they're doing, is saying, yeah, us too. See, we're weird just like you guys.
Yeah.
You know, you guys have weird stuff too. It's just that it's less weird to see the nun's habit, the priest's robe, all these things, because we see it and because we've seen it growing up, and my kids have seen yarmulkes and have seen all these other religious vestments because they're external. And I don't know. That's there are, is my understanding, and I'm not, you know, I used to be a lot better about this stuff when I was in college. But there are some Jewish garments, right? Some undergarments that kind of hang down and are underneath the clothes. Is that what it is? I thought there was something a little more closer to garments.
I'm reaching way back. I haven't lived in New York for some time, but you'll see it in the Hasidic Jewish population. This is the population that will typically have the ringlets that they've kind of curled out of their hair and the beards.
The real Orthodox, right?
Correct, and the flat-brimmed hats. If you look sort of around where their shirt ends, you will see the prayer shawl sticking out, and they'll always wear this. And they don't necessarily hide it per se. I mean, you can definitely see it. But my understanding is that it's a garment that they wear at all times, at least the male Jewish population. I don't claim to be an expert in Judaism, so I could be wrong.
Okay. So the video starts off by trying to place Mormonism among all these other traditions and saying, that there's a rich history of different forms of worship, songs, prayer, clothing.
The nun's habit, the priest's cassock, the Jewish prayer shawl, the Muslim skull cap, the saffron robes of the Buddhist monk. All are part of a rich tapestry of human devotion to God.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of criticisms about this.
Yeah.
About this video, I know a lot of people did, and I didn't as much because it is something that I used to use the same analogy as, you know, this is the same as the priest collar or the. You know, they're symbols, and it's a representation of covenants, and we just wear ours on the inside. And at the time, I used to say that in a way that was a little, I guess, condescending to the other religions, which is like, "Ha, we don't, we're keeping these, you know, truly sacred, and keeping these to ourselves. We're not showing, our righteousness or our." The way we're approaching God, we're doing this very—it's
more humble
internally. Yeah,
we're not being ostentatious with our
right, yeah. Right. but I it does, you know, it did. I guess I buy into it. I think it's true that they are certainly equivalent to some of these other, some of these other. Clothing, or I guess
where do you see that equivalence? Because I think Chelsea said they're not, you know, but was talking about the historicity of them, you know, where you can place them in time and discover an origin for them or not, that they're not similar, but you see that there are some similarities.
Yeah, I mean, the similarities in that they're a religious symbolism, and there is a religious connotation they choose to wear to remind them of whatever that is,
express their devotion to God.
Yeah, and you know, I can't say, oh, the garments are somehow bad or somehow weird, and you know, the yarmulke, these other things are sure that makes a lot of sense to me. They're all silly, and you know, I don't really have a lot of value for it personally, but. You know, if that person does, great. Well, I take it back. I do think that the garments are actually a little more inhibiting and uncomfortable, and maybe prevent things like, you know, intimacy between husband and wife and whatever. But I don't know. Feel the chill. I'm really not offended by that they decided to put it out and say, here's where they are, especially just like anything. It seems like this move of polygamy, the polygamy essays, run the gamut of what the church has been doing over the course of the last year. All this stuff is on the internet anyway, so why not embrace it and put it out there? You can find the temple clothes online. You can find the garments online. So you might as well put it out and try to do it in a way that you control the message or you control how they're presented.
Yeah.
I agree completely with that. The concept of let's take our own message and let's control our own message to a degree. I mean, that's just PR 101, right? I disagree though that they're the same as a lot of the examples they used. I think that when you're talking about yarmulkes and you're talking about sort of, you know, skull caps, the prayer shawls, okay, I follow you that far. But when you start getting into papal vestments or priest collars or the robes that monks wear in Buddhism, that's where you lose me, because number one, the people who wear them in the church are not solely the clergy, even though we have a lay clergy. I think it's hard to argue that women fulfill a clerical role as the church is currently constituted, at least on any kind of an equal basis. So it breaks down there. And it's not, you know, you're limited in these other religions to a select class of people, right? I mean, there's, you know, I don't know how many Buddhists, but, you know, a billion Buddhists, more than that, across the world. And yet only a very select few are actually monks who are in these monasteries wearing these kind of robes. There's only very few, comparatively speaking, you know, pastors and priests in various other Christian denominations that wear those kind of religious vestments. Whereas this is, I would say, mandatory. It's a mandatory raiment for all adult Mormons, and one that carries a specific promise of exaltation. I don't know that any of those other vestments do that.
Well, I think there's some degree of distinction. I mean, I don't think there's like different ranks, but if you've got a member who's wearing garments and a member who's not wearing garments, people look at them differently.
Absolutely. It definitely is a hierarchy,
yeah.
Where
at least two tiers.
Unless it's workout clothes. That seems to be the new sort of loophole, especially when I go back to Utah. And I'm speaking of women generally. Chelsea, maybe you know more about this than I do, but it seems like, you know, women will go pretend to work out and then just stay in their workout clothes all day. And that's how they get around it.
Right. I saw something. I saw something. If wearing yoga pants and intending to work out burn calories, I'd be super thin. And that's kind of how I feel when I put my exercise. But I did want to ask you, Chelsea, is there anything – I'm thinking of maybe some cultural something in either the African culture or something to designate a person as part of the tribe, part of the group. And I'm so ignorant about that stuff, but whether it be some of the piercings, or is there a vestment in African cultures to say this designates this person as part of this tribe?
Absolutely. So it doesn't have to necessarily be a tattoo or a scarification, and all cultures have these.
Yeah.
But they're, you could call them vestments, or you could call them, we call them costly signals. So something that's very costly and hard to fake, like a garment. So it's very hard to get something like a garment, right? You have to get a temple recommend. You have to wear them every single day. It's not easy to follow all of those rules. Yeah. And so if we see someone with a garment, if it's poking through their shirt, we assume so much about a person. So in my cultural anthropology 101 class at Utah Valley University, I asked my students who are 90% Mormon, what do you assume about someone, a woman, who walks in on the first day of class in a sleeveless outfit? And there are a million things they assume about this woman, right? That she's sexually active, that she's not Mormon, that she drinks, that she smokes. It's incredible the amount of information that these students will come up with based on the fact that they don't see her garments, and vice versa. I say, what if you see someone with garments? What are the myriad of things you assume? And so that's what these vestments are, is a costly signal that's so hard to fake that no one would be wearing garments if they're faking it. Therefore, the garment stands for these qualities that you want to have and that you want other people in your community to have, because they are costly. And, you know, and this is, we see this all across cultures, right? From the veil is a perfect example, the hijab, the abaya. Like all of these different, you know, the yarmulke, like we could name all of these vestments that are basically communicating to others that you've made an important commitment to your group, right? And you wouldn't do that.
So can we say it's less religious? It's less religious and more cultural then?
You know, I would say more social. It's less religious and more of like, this is my in group. I'm loyal to them. And when you see this thing, there's a lot of flack I get, right? There's a lot of flack people get for wearing a veil. Especially in Europe right now. And so if you're going to continue to do that practice, it must really mean something to you. I mean, garments are especially hard to wear for women. And we can talk about gendered, you know, garments in a second if you want. But, and so if you're going to do that, if you're going to wear this garment, you are basically separating yourself from the larger American community and saying you're loyal to this Mormon community, which people actually in the community love. It's saying you're loyal to them. They trust you. They instantaneously believe hundreds of things about you the second they see your garment line.
And my guess is that that's a much larger investment for a woman than it is for a man, because the styles of male underwear are much more similar to a garment than I think the fashion and the styles for female underwear.
Absolutely.
Right. Like, that's what I wanted to bring up. Yeah. The line in this.
Well, I beat you to it. So
the line in the video that drove me crazy was, there was this line and I wrote it down. It said, quote unquote,
similar in design to ordinary modest underclothing. It comes in two pieces and is usually referred to as the temple garment.
It's similar in design to ordinary modest underclothing. And like, that was the line. And I'm like, are you kidding? That only for men, like, you can see boxer briefs that kind of resemble the male bottom, and undershirts, you know, resemble the male top. But there is
almost
nothing
completely.
Right. Yeah.
The male top now is a crew neck, or you can buy
a t-shirt. Yeah.
Totally. And the male tops have like transitioned based on fashion of the day. Like the crew neck, right, became more common because people weren't wearing silky like. Very deep necked V-neck.
The disco, you know what I mean?
right. So like the male top has very much gone with fashion of the day. We can see this transition. What's interesting about the female version is that that statement cannot be more ludicrous. There is nothing about a female top or a female bottom that looks anything like ordinary undergarments for women, right? And so it just becomes this whole issue of like, we can talk about, you know, modesty and bodies and culture, or we can talk about this issue of like Mormon gendered views that everything in the church is gendered male and women are kind of the offshoot. Like, well, these are normal. And women are just kind of like, well, you're just the offshoot. You're the byproduct. Well,
that's the story of the garments in the first place anyway, because they never had female versions until what, the 1960s, 70s, maybe?
Were they unisex?
They were unisex based on the male pattern from back in the 1830s
ish
or so.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And which is why they didn't have cups until like this year.
Exactly. I mean, Chelsea, I'm with you, except they lost me on that statement before they even got to the underwear part. The word modesty, for the love of Calvin Klein, it has no business being anywhere near the words underwear, right? Who cares
about
it's
modest underwear.
That's the whole point. I mean, unless you guys, you know, have some sort of a nudist fetish that I don't know about, I'm going to wager that you don't, you know, walk around in your underwear outside very often. I certainly don't, except to pick up the paper, maybe.
Yeah.
But underoos are kind of fun.
Yeah, no, they're great.
The piece that jumped out to me, and I do want to get into these gender roles and those things, but we might be able to close the book on at least one piece, is they jump to right away that they're referred to as magic underwear or magic, and that's not only untrue, but offensive.
Some people incorrectly refer to temple garments as magical or magic underwear. These words are not only inaccurate, but also offensive to members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There is nothing magical or mystical about temple garments, and church members ask for the same degree of respect and sensitivity that would be afforded to any other faith by people of goodwill.
And I thought, really? That I understand that the spin there is it's a lot hyperbolic and it's very rhetorical, but to say that's untrue.
These words are not only inaccurate.
I grew up all the time hearing about it being a physical shield and protector. And you hear stories all the time about people having bullets shot at them, fires, car accidents, and they have scars and injuries everywhere but where their garments are. So it was a little, if not a lot, misleading that hasn't permeated our culture as it being physical protector.
I had to go back and listen to how they said it, but I think they said that members get offended if they hear other people call them magic. And I mean, I think that's absolutely a true statement, because yes, you'll hear members tell stories about how they were protected by their garments, but they never use the word magic.
Right, but that's why I say it's hyperbolic and it's rhetorical, but it does encompass what people say when
But it's not using the acceptable in-group language.
Right, but what they said is that's not only untrue or that's not only false, it's offensive, and it's the false part that I had a problem with that I think was misleading.
That they're not considered to be magical.
They are considered by and I'm sure that's something that's not talked about as much, except I remember 96 when the 60 minute documentary,
the Marriott story.
Yeah, the Marriott.
Yeah.
We're not a weird people.
A weird people?
Yes.
Mormons know that some outsiders think they are weird. Why? Well, for one thing, devout Mormons wear sacred undergarments for protection from harm. Cotton undershirts with undershorts that reach to their knees. Do you wear the sacred undergarments?
Yes, I do. And I can tell you they do protect you from harm.
Really?
Uh-huh. I was in a very serious boat accident. Fire. Boat was on fire. I was on fire. Mm-hmm. I was burned. My pants were burned right off me. I was not burned above my knee. Where the garment was, I was not burned.
And you believe it was the sacred undergarments?
Yeah, I do, particularly on my legs, because my pants were gone. My undergarments were not singed.
And Marriott has a story about, this has absolutely happened to me. I was in a fire, and I was burned everywhere except where my garments. And I kind of laughed even then. I thought, but yeah, you have two layers of clothes there. That kind of makes sense. You literally have two barriers. Then what I liked is they jumped to Steve Young and asked him, right. Well, do you believe that the garments protect you on the field?
And do you think that the sacred undergarments have kept you from harm on the football field?
I actually take them off to play football. The sacred nature of them, I find that the nature of football and the sweating and so forth, I actually take them off. And I think that's probably prevalent with athletics in the church.
Really?
But my teammates have enjoyed when you're getting dressed and you put your garments on. They think they're pretty cool, a lot of them. They say, hey, where'd you get those? And I always tell them they're way too expensive.
Yeah, so I was working in the folklore archives at BYU when those came out, and the professor there, Bert Wilson, when I talked to him, he just rolled his eyes. He's like, I was so upset when that aired, that Marriott said that.
The Marriott thing.
Yeah, because it perpetuates this folk belief that isn't – it's not the image that people really want out there, even though it's a legitimate – folk belief. I mean, it's their part of Mormon culture. But yeah, I think my biggest criticism of this whole piece, and I agree with what you said earlier, Matt, I don't really have a lot of criticism towards it. I think it's kind of an interesting thing that they did, but they are very selective in the types of tradition that they accept and the tradition that they reject. And, you know, as somebody that studied folklore, this was like the introduction of not costumes, but clothing and songs and prayer was like folklore 101 class to me. And that, yeah, these are all these man-made things that are passed along through tradition, and they're communally shared and recreated. And, you know, some of them get pulled out and canonized and made to seem more official, but they're all kind of ground up man-made type things. Like, so where I take issue that the garments are different than these other things, for a Mormon, they would say, God's the one that revealed what garments should be to us. But all these other things just sprung up out of the ground, or maybe were a bastardization of something that God once revealed to a group, but that they're all kind of grassroots thing and traditional. But ours aren't traditional in that sense, where there's no author. There actually is an author, and you can trace it right back directly to God. And so when they say things like the garments, you know, aren't magical, you know, they're denying that belief that really does exist in Mormonism. And when they say that there's no customary dress, or some language like on Sunday there's no required dress code for church.
In the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there are no outer religious vestments in ordinary worship services. However, many faithful Latter-day Saints wear a garment under their clothing that has deep religious significance.
You know, Chelsea, what happened the first time you wore pants?
I got in big, big trouble.
Yeah, right? I mean, there are these, right. Like, traditional, you know, culturally expected things that, you know, sometimes they accept in this narrative, sometimes they reject them, and it was that inconsistency that really drove me nuts as I was watching.
You know, it's not just church. I can go to Costco here in Texas, and I can pick out the Mormons.
Oh, absolutely.
In seconds, because the garments dictate a style of dress. And now that I'm looking for it, and I do, I look for it when I go to Costco just because it's easy to do and it's fun. it's as obvious to me as Amish dresses in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'll look at someone and say, oh, yeah, that's got to be a Mormon. And they'll turn around and it's a BYU shirt or something like that. It's very easy.
Was that white undershirt that the, you know, like a white t-shirt under a tank top that the girls wear, and it's clearly not meant to be to go together, but it kind of works, but not really, and that's the one, that's what you see here a lot, and you can really pick that, you know, pick that out.
Or on the women's side, you know, this is just the other day, my wife was picking up our kid from school. And there's a lot of Mormons in our area, and you know, she meets up with one of her friends, and she could clearly see, you know, her friend's, you know, shirt, undershirt, bra line, garment line, you know, like five layers of clothes here in you know, in Texas, where it's still in the mid 80s, and no doubt that person was just completely sweltering, and you know, that person would have been shocked to know that you could so easily see that. But it's just a really obvious marker that, you know, you can pick up, and sometimes exploit it. I mean, did you ever, at BYU, put masking tape around your quads, to go underneath your jeans?
No.
When you were a freshman?
No,
That's awesome.
I used it to hold the cucumber in place.
There were a few of us freshman year at BYU. This is all pre-mission. Who, in order to get dates with older women, would strategically put masking tape and a thick layer, two or three deep, right on our thighs, and wear, you know, a crew neck shirt, and that was a signal, and it was a cultural marker that we were, I don't know if you want to call it sexually available, but at least romantically available to a class of women we otherwise had no chance with.
Okay,
that's the most amazing thing I have ever heard in my life. That's incredible. Yeah. So you're faking the signals that are hard to fake in order to appear dateable and eligible in a Mormon context. Amazing.
Correct. Yeah. So what would happen when they would get your pants off and see the tape?
Oh, that's right. It was BYU.
Right.
Yeah, it never got any closer than mild petting.
Yeah. Mild. That's an actual
mild
category.
No, it's light. Actual category. Light petting instead of heavy petting.
Yeah. Which I don't know. The Mormon definition of light petting might mean, you know, mild, you know, some minor tongue. I don't know.
Is it stroking the cheek?
Yeah.
So I have a crazy story too, kind of like that. I have did all my research in West Africa, so it's enormously hot, way humid, but I was still super Mormon, so I wore garments. So you're sweating, you know, you're walking 12 miles a day, you're sweating intensely. The problem with garments in Ghana is that you have to hand wash them, and all of the clothing is made for an American washer and dryer. It's not made for third world or developing countries. And so once you hand wash your garment, they kind of really stretch out. And then on top of that, you have to air dry them and then iron them. Everything that you wash has to be ironed because there's this thing called botfly that if anything's damp, it can lay eggs in your clothing and then like hatch inside of your skin. It's like the grossest thing ever.
I've seen the YouTube videos.
Okay, okay, good.
They're nasty. Good.
Right. So if you're
See, that's how you know God doesn't exist.
It's scary, right? So if you're living in Africa, all of these Mormons, you have to hand like iron. And I've seen people iron their garments with one of those old school irons that you probably saw your grandparents in, where you put like hot coals inside of it and then iron it. So you have to iron these garments. And what's so fascinating is by the end of my time in Africa, I had those, you know, the new Karenessa, like really stretchy, like biker short types garments. And by the end of my year, the second time I was there, well, the fifth time I was there, but the end of that year, my garments were hanging down to my calves. because they're not made to be like ironed, right? And so it was just this crazy cultural clash of like, here's where I have to, here's how I have to like participate with this material, and it's not working. And it was actually this really fascinating experience. We were hanging out with a lot of non-members, expats, and it was super hot, and we were taking this like public transportation, and she saw my garments. She's like, what are those? And I was like, oh, they're just kind of – and she's like, are you wearing bloomers? In her mind, that was the only possible word she could come up with for like why anyone in like the hottest climate ever would be wearing something underneath the skirt. Like she could not think of a word that's appropriate besides bloomers, right? And so it's super, super crazy. And they are trying like lately to come up with more types of material that can be sustained in that kind of culture. And so the church is trying to respond to the needs of the global South. But what's fascinating, if we get back to kind of some of this gendered stuff, is the change from one piece to two piece garments is actually on the shoulders of feminists. That, you know, feminists started a letter writing campaign and started talking to their leaders and saying, look, nursing is enormously difficult in a one piece garment. If you guys can imagine for me, after you have a baby,
we'll try.
You're completely bleeding for 6 weeks. Literally. I'm sorry if this is too crazy or too crass, but you're totally bleeding for 6 weeks. You're leaking from your breasts milk all of the time. And it's so hard to wear garments during that period. Now imagine having to nurse a baby every, you know, hour to 2 hours and having to take off one piece garments to do that. And so women actually started this campaign to say, look, one piece garments were never designed for women and they're enormously hard during nursing. And the cool thing is they basically got a response that said, hey, yeah, we've never actually thought about that. Not one of us in decision-making capacities has ever had to nurse a baby. And they made this two-piece garment, which is pretty fascinating. And
I would venture to say that all the changes garments have had are due to feminist input. Because the changes in the 1920s, where they went from the wrists and the ankles to the elbows and knees, were a direct result of the fashions of the time of the 1920s, in which the younger generation of women in the church just flat out refused to wear them and said, we're not going to do this because they don't meet with the fashions that we would like to wear. And that was, in my view, the strongest impetus into actually changing from that wrist and ankle style to the, I think they went mid-calf and elbow at that point.
That's your response, Chelsea.
Oh, I mean, I completely agree. I think that, yeah, we're seeing changes based on fashion. I think probably the, you know, one of the last gendered parts that I wanted to say was about like the regulation of garments. The fact that you meet with a leader and the temple recommend interview question is, you know, do you wear your garments? I know that, there's been a lot of feminist critique of that. There's been women who have really struggled with different health issues from miscarrying to, you know, heavy periods. And garments are not made to be able to like hold a menstrual pad. I'm sorry again if this is crass, but I think it's important to talk about these issues. We actually have a woman on Feminist Mormon Housewives that was struggling so much with some health issues that she was like, I can't wear these garments. They don't hold in my pad. I'm bleeding everywhere. What can I do? She went in to ask her bishop because she felt like the garment is not an undergarment. It's a religious symbol. And so the person she needed to go to for advice is not other women or her doctor. It was a bishop. So she goes in to talk to her bishop about like how it's so impossible to wear these garment bottoms when you're dealing with female issues. And he, a guy who has never experienced this problem, says to her, huh, never thought about that. I wonder if you should try Depends, the adult diapers for people.
Oh, wow.
No lie. No
lie. That went over well, I'm sure.
Right. Well, and here's my problem is I've had that experience myself. I had my daughter And within, you know, it usually takes about 6 weeks to fully recover from childbirth. It was 3 weeks. I decided to teach my Relief Society lesson. I only went into church for that 1 hour to teach my Relief Society lesson and then hurried home to go nurse and be with my daughter, who was just 3 weeks old. So I wasn't wearing garments because it was the only thing I could – a bra was the only thing I could – that could keep in nursing pads that made me not leak everywhere. And underwear, you know, not traditionally modest underwear, but like real women's underwear, were the only thing I could keep a pad in. Again, sorry if this is crass. But that's kind of the only way I could figure out what to do. So I got called into an impromptu Temple Recommend interview. I know that sounds weird, but it was, you know, a couple months after I wore pants and people thought I was really scary. So they gave me a Temple Recommend interview before mine was even expired. And when he got to the – and I was able to answer everything the right way. When he got to the garments, I kind of had a freak out moment because up until this point, I had worn my garments every single day since I went through the temple. No problems. I wore them the right way. I never tucked. Like, I was a super garment wearer. And when he asked that question, I just very bluntly said, oh, my goodness. Like, I wear my garments, but I'm nursing and I'm leaking and I'm bleeding and my daughter's only 3 weeks and, like, I couldn't figure out. And so, oh, my goodness, I'm not wearing them right now. And I was really humiliated. And he kind of gave me a hard time. The first counselor said, well, I know my wife and daughters, you know, have had kids and they've been able to wear their garments just fine, young lady.
They put it on the outside. Isn't that like a common right. practice? No, I'm serious.
I've witnessed this. I've seen it too.
I mean, we don't have a strict pattern, right? Some women don't wear them. Some women wear them on top of their normal underwear. Some women try to put nursing pads within them. Like, it's crazy for women that you don't have any idea of, like, how this stuff works. And no one told me. Not one person told me, girl, you're fine. Just don't wear them until you're healthy. No one told me, you know, you're not fine. Wear them on top. I mean, no one instructed me how to deal with this thing that didn't fit my biology. And when I went to my church leaders who regulated my underwear wearing, you know, he was enormously condescending. And, you know, it was a hard issue where from that point on, I realized, maybe I should stop bringing my concerns to men who don't understand at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would depend. The problem with that is the same woman could get an absolute different answer from a bishop who might be a little more, whether it be liberal or understanding or empathetic, whatever, depending on – and that's a problem. There's no –
they don't put this in the bishop's handbook. They need to,
That's the problem.
Well, as I'm hearing Chelsea's experience, frankly, with just the pants, right? I mean, my wife wore pants that same day. I'm presuming it was the wear pants to church day. My wife wore pants and everyone just kind of said hi. The stake president went out of his way to make sure we felt welcome. And that was that. But that's just sort of, you know, your leadership roulette, right? Which especially when your leadership is all male, it I think highlights the issue of I don't know. I'll just say patriarchy and be done.
Yeah. I guess. I'm a little surprised because I'm a man, but that there isn't other women that are helping in your case, Chelsea, helping you figure out how to do this and still do it in the right Mormon way, so you can still keep your garments on and keep your covenants, but you just put the, you know, supportive briefs on outside, or you put your bra on outside of your top, or those things, which always seems so uncomfortable, but like you said earlier, that's the cost. That's what you're willing to do to show your devotion to this church and your devotion to God above anything else, even your own comfort. I guess I kind of went away from my original point there, but I'm just surprised that women aren't helping women with that.
Right. Well, that's what makes it so complicated, right? Because there's certain women that think you have to wear your garments underneath your bra. There's certain women that think you have to wear it on top of.
Yeah.
There's other women that think that you have to wear your garments through all of your surgeries and hysterectomies and menstrual periods. There's other people that like, well, you take a week off of garments because it doesn't function properly.
Yeah.
You know, it's so varied what people think. I mean, I remember my mom coming to my newlywed apartment where you like go to the laundromat to wash your garments.
Yeah.
And she was horrified implied that my garments were kind of grayish tinged.
White symbolizes purity.
And I was like, sorry, I've been washing them in whites. I don't know what to tell you. She was like, these should be absolutely white. Yeah. And she called the church office building and found out that garments are not actually white. They're dyed white, and that I had stripped the dye, and that's why my garments were gray. I mean, she was horrified that they weren't the right color of white, you know? And there's just such a variation on what we're taught about garments, what we're taught is the correct way to, you know, for get rid of them, to wear them, that it gets really, really confusing, probably more for women just because their bodies change over time in a way that men's don't. But there's not a clear set of, like, if you're a good Mormon woman, you wear your garments this way. Yeah. It's an enormous diversity.
Well, it's not just a woman. I mean, I agree that this absolutely disproportionately affects women by far. That's without question, I think. But it also can affect men in really weird ways. One of the things that I do for fun is run marathons, and I've run quite a few in Utah. And every time I run a marathon in Utah, without fail, I will see at least, you know, 3-4 dozen guys wearing garments while they're running. You'll see the basketball shorts, and every time they lift up one leg, there'll be 2 inches of authorized pattern just hanging right out. To me, running a marathon with garments on is the best conceptualization of hell that I can possibly come up with. I can't imagine the chafing and the, you know, ridiculous amount of body glide that you're going to need to sort of eliminate all the friction and just
so they don't get some kind of like divine boost.
No. Huh. In fact, when you're running, especially longer distances like that, the whole idea is to keep your body temperature lower, because as it gets warmer, you'll slow down. So wearing an extra layer of clothes like that, especially when it's all the way, you know, through your torso, is just a horrible way to have good times. And you know, I mean, look at the BYU track team. They don't do that. Most people, well, not most, but a lot of people who are devout Mormons will still, you know, for that duration, wear, you know, your regular running shorts and shirt or singlet or whatever. But among sort of at least, and you don't see as many women running. I've never seen, I don't think, a woman run a marathon in garments, thankfully. But no, I take that back. I have. Never mind. There is this sort of class of super devout men who take that, you know, never take them off concept very seriously, and won't even do it won't even take them off for something that is, I mean, it's obvious you should be taking them off. I would think that that would fall under almost anybody's exception, you know, sort of Steve Young rule. And yet I see it every time I run one in Utah.
That reminds me. I need to, at some point, I need to talk about Stephen Erastus Knudsen III, because he was my satirical creation in my senior English satire class at BYU that epitomized all of these, like, ultra-righteous people that would take everything to the absolute extreme. I had a lot of fun with that character. Anyway, that's kind of an aside. I want to go back to your mom, Chelsea, and her freak out over the color of your garments not being white, because this is something that I came across in my studies. Wondering if you've come across the idea of simulacrum. Do you know that, this term?
No, please explain.
Okay. I can't pronounce this guy's name because it's French and I'm terrible with this, but it's, I think Jean Baudrillard, something like that, came up with this idea of simulacrum. And it's a pretty simple idea that it's just human nature that when there's an object of devotion that's a symbol, over time what happens is whatever that object is representing, the idea or the concept, that gets forgotten or it becomes of secondary importance, and what raises in importance is the actual thing itself, until it gets to the point where that's what's being worshipped or that's what's being revered. And I see that all the time in Mormon symbology and ritual and all these things, and that's what your mom was doing when she said, oh my gosh, it's not white, it's supposed to be white. It's like, okay, you have forgotten what these pieces of cloth are representing, and you're focusing way too much on the pieces of cloth themselves. And I had this experience once in the temple. It was one of the last times I went through, where you've got your temple garments in that little pouch before you put them on, and there's no place to really rest them. Maybe you rest them on your lap or something. So I put them down on the ground next to me. And this old man, he must have been in his 70s, behind me, just started having a fit. He was like, I turn around and I look, and he's pointing at them, and he's like very aggressively pointing, like, get them off of the ground. I was just thinking, chill out, man. And this was in the Mesa Temple, Matt, which is on the second floor anyway, so it's not even on like ground level. Like, I don't even, I couldn't imagine. This is, 20 feet above the actual ground, but that there was something about these things, like an American flag that can't touch the ground, or else you have to destroy them and it gets soiled, and there's some kind of purity in these things themselves that is lost if you, I don't know, do whatever. So anyway, that's always been an interesting concept to me, the simulacrum. I wanted to talk about it, so I just did.
I heard of a story of a member of the church who was a sex offender and was abusing a kid, and it was learned that they took off their garments in order to abuse this kid, and that was something that that other members of the church would focus on and say, well, that's really bad. It's really bad that he would take off his garments and put them on the floor. When he would abuse this kid, can you believe that? And when I heard this story, I thought, can I believe that? Yeah, I can believe that, but I'm a little more offended the fact that he's touching a kid, not the fact that he's putting cloth on the ground. So it just highlights that mentality that exists.
I think I've mentioned this before, but I think one of the reasons that idea of simulacrum was so interesting to me, because I did it, I recognized those tendencies in myself at the time that I was really a devout believer. And when I went through the temple for the first time and I felt like, okay, I've got these garments, I've made this covenant, I'm good in the eyes of the Lord now, I'm pure, like I'm white. If I'm going to have some kind of youthful indiscretion, as boys sometimes do as they're falling asleep, I'm not going to do that in these garments. But then I messed up and I'm like, okay, this pair of garments is my masturbation garments. the other five pairs that I have are still pure and I don't want to desecrate them. So like I had my go-to pair if I ever, had that urge. But it's just crazy. Like at some point I just realized this is so crazy. This whole idea of, and maybe it goes back to the magic, that there's some kind of power infused in these things. You see it with the sacrament too, like having to cover up the water when you're praying for the bread, or cover up the bread when you're praying for the water. So what's exposed, I just find that interesting. The other thing about this video and temple garments and maybe getting back to where we were talking about the video, I thought it was really interesting that they said that when men put on the temple robe, there's no indication of rank. So you can't tell the difference between the highest apostle or the most novice, newest member of the church. I thought that was pretty cool.
There is no insignia or rank. The highest apostle and the newest member are indistinguishable when dressed in the same way. Men and women wear similar clothing.
Until they went over and they said, and the women's temple clothing is similar to the men's. And that was like my thing that I went, no, it's not. Men aren't veiling their faces, the biggest thing there. So Chelsea, I was curious if that part stuck out to you as well.
Absolutely. It totally did. And I'm kind of with Matt that like, I was really, really, really disappointed that they belittled the idea of magical underwear. And I know they did it semantically.
Yeah.
And I'm with you, Glenn, that it's totally a semantic, like that's really disingenuous to the lived experience of having, a protective clothing, just call them magical underwear. Right. But I'm with Matt that, the way I grew up was all of these stories, and not just stories of my friends, so-and-so, but like of my dad, of uncles, of people I was close to telling me these stories of wearing garments, and garments are the thing that saved their lives, you know, falling from buildings and miraculously surviving, or cutting their leg and it only cutting, you know, their first layer of clothing and their garment, but not penetrating their leg. Yeah. And, you know, these crazy stories of quote unquote magical properties of these garments. And what I think it comes down to, the whole video, if we want to get back to the video, if I were to analyze that video, what it comes down to is the number one kind of contradiction in Mormonism that I think currently exists, which is they want to be just like everyone else. Like, we are normal. We're just like you. We're just like all those other religions out there.
But while they're really saying is don't make fun of us.
Right. Like, we're just like you. Like, don't think we're weird.
Yeah.
At the same time, Mormons want to maintain that they're peculiar, that they're different. So I said that word weird, that we're peculiar.
You said that
we're
peculiarly.
Right. I couldn't say it right. Like, we have this weird juxtaposition that Mormons want to maintain both at the same time. We want to be just like everyone else, but we also want to be completely different than everyone else. And we constantly are seeing that in all the things that we produce, from Meet the Mormons to I'm a Mormon campaign to this video that just came out. Like, look at these ancient traditions. We're just like everyone else. And yet, like, we still want to be different than everyone else. It's this unique, like, you know, contradiction that is constantly being played out in Mormon messages.
Yeah. And fueled by things like the Book of Mormon musical, you know, or anytime Bill Maher goes on a rant about Mormons and magical underwear, you know, things like that, that they're still... Mormons are a whipping boy for a lot of things in the world. And so I think we're going to keep seeing these kind of conflicting messages that say, come on, guys, don't make fun of us. We're weird just like every other religious group is weird.
Well, it's we want to be like everyone else, or we want to be treated like everyone else, yet at the same time, other people who aren't in our group. So we have our special codes and the things that make us not just different but better.
Yeah.
We don't drink. We don't drink coffee. And these things make us very different than you. But we're just like you. I see it as a way of them othering non-members, because especially in a place where they have a lot of social or political influence, here in the West in particular.
You don't have to say othering non-members. You could just say othering the world. And we know what you're talking about.
Right. Othering
the world.
Others.
Yeah.
So they also talk about the temple clothes and show those. And I thought it was funny that they lay them out and they say, the temple clothes are all white to represent purity. And then they look down there and say, well, what's that green thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know, and it might. I at some point it might. I wonder if it will. If the temple ceremony would be a little more out there. I've always maintained that if the church would just show what happens, just show how boring it really is. That there's nothing. There's really nothing to see. That it would go away. A lot of religions have very structured rituals and these types of things. That if they didn't keep it secret, that it would become a non-issue.
Yeah, but I think you're diluting the power of the ritual if you do that, because I think there's a lot of occult, hidden, special, secret, you know, that is a like powerful identity binding thing that would dilute a little bit if you did that. So I don't know, because people in my circle, and I'm thinking mainly of my dad, but others, loved to do this well. You'll know more about that when you go through the temple. You know, I know right now.
Right.
I could tell you, but you're going to find out when you go through the temple. And then, you know, it's this rite of passage that, you know, it's hidden knowledge. When you qualify, you can get it, and then you're qualified. So I think it would take away from that a little bit.
The last thing I wanted to say is just, I think it'd be interesting on a podcast like this to kind of maybe discuss like our experience of wearing garments and taking them off.
Uh-huh.
Like one thing that was fascinating to me, and maybe this is gendered, I don't know, I'm just curious. One thing that was fascinating to me is when I stopped wearing garments, it was only about a year ago.
Yeah.
I appreciated my body in a way that I never had before. Before it was like garments hid my body. And so, you know, you're married for eternity. Who the fuck cares what you look like?
Whoa.
Sorry. But the second
I wasn't wowing the fuck. I was wowing the attitude.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
But like that's, I mean, kind of what you feel like as you get married and Mormon, you know. Your body is no longer something that's attractive necessarily. It's a contractual arrangement for the rest of eternity. So the shape and size and look of your body is no longer something, you know, that attracts men, right? Your body becomes just this thing that gives birth to children. And so what was fascinating for me is when I took off my garments and began wearing those quote unquote, you know, traditional underclothing, you know, that were like bras and underwear. Mm. I began to appreciate my actual body, its health, its shape, its size, in a way that I never had with garments. Mm. And I think that that was an interesting kind of realization I came to, that as a woman, the garments kind of hid my body, and not wearing garments kind of exposed my body and made me pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if men experience the same thing, and I'm just wondering.
Well, I'm waiting for Matt to say, that's hot.
Yeah, that's hot.
That's hot.
I just really appreciate women's underwear. You know, the non-modest kind. And I'm not saying thongs. I'm not saying that, but just, you know, like a nice boy short or a booty short. They're really freaking cute.
Yeah.
And there was really it's just very different to approach. I don't know, to appreciate your wife physically wearing those, you know, wearing that type of underwear. And you just, I'm sorry, I just can't with garments. I found garments, what's the word? Boner killing? Boner
but,
killing?
But you're talking about your reaction to, you know, what Kristen was wearing, right? Your experience absolutely. With your own body and your own garments, like when you made that decision to stop wearing them?
My garments, I wore the boxer briefs, and I wore them kind of, you know, you could get the short by the mid 90s, right. You could get the short, and I don't have a short leg, so yeah. They would sit, you know, probably 3 or 4 inches up my knee, and once you washed them half a dozen times, they're even shorter.
Right.
But you know, I had a mission companion who was really short and a little heavier, and this poor kid's garments were like, you know, Chelsea's bloomers.
Yeah.
I mean, they went down almost mid-calf, and my wife used to always complain because she's very short. She's 5'2", and her sisters are like 5'8", 5'9", and she would complain because that would be a very – she would be more limited than her sisters in what they would wear or they could wear just because of height. And whoever is, you know, tailoring these don't really – don't really account for that. So to answer your question directly, you know, the only difference was the color, really, is they raised about 3 or 4 inches, and, you know, now they're something other than white, but really the shape. Yeah, garments I always thought were comfortable, and I wore them for a long time, even after being a believer, because they were relatively comfortable.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so I think it's a very different experience for a man than it is for a woman, because that comfort, it's not impeding on any kind of style that we would rather go for. Because I was like that as well, Matt. When I stopped wearing them regularly was just because I was divorced and I was dating. And, you know, so the question that I asked Nick earlier, what happened when, you know, they saw it was just tape around your legs? I didn't want to have those conversations. Like, what are those? You know, I'm just like, I'm not going to worry about it. So sometimes I would wear garments normally, but then if I was going out on a date, I wouldn't, you know, or something like that. So, yeah.
You know,
and then eventually I just made the switch. And,
you know, I was just going to say that my experience is more along the lines of what Chelsea's was from a male perspective, in that, and it's still, for me, it's been about a year and a half, maybe. For my wife, it's been probably about 6 months, maybe not even quite that. No, it's about 6 months. And her reaction was exactly like Chelsea's. And she actually talks specifically about this and still does, about how her own body image has changed dramatically, where she's happy with who she is and how she looks in a way that she wasn't before. In addition to the sexual dynamics that it carried between the two of us, where, I mean, we refer to garments now as a sex prevention suit, there was also a self-esteem factor that I had, and I think part of it was tied to sort of my own, years of cognitive dissonance, where I was actively participating in something I didn't believe in and kind of felt very hypocritical. I think that the act of taking them off, and for a long time I actually only would wear them on Sundays, so, you know, I would wear them to church and then I wouldn't wear them for the rest of the week. That made sense to me, and it somehow reflected that balance. And when I took them off altogether, I think that was really my first steps out. But there was a definite physical, look at myself in the mirror type of feeling better about how I looked idea when I took mine off all the way, definitely.
Glenn, I'll have one final comment. I don't know that you want to add it or anything, but it was way back at the beginning, but I just didn't get a chance to say it. There is something interesting about how all of the other images of vestments worn by these ancient or cross-cultural religions were embodied, right? They showed images of the clothing. It was embodied and it was external.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Mormonism is that they show these images of these garments completely unembodied, and they're internal. And I think that actually says a lot about our culture. That, like, we value the body, but it also terrifies us to show a woman or a man in their garments. To us, to most Mormons, they would see that as completely, almost pornographic. They would see that as disrespectful. They'd see that as sexual. Like, the body is not in and of itself valued.
Not sexual.
As what, right, right. We claim that the body is this amazing thing and that we don't see the body the way, like a Puritan type of religion sees the body. And yet in all reality, Mormons are terrified of bodies, so that's why we see so many unembodied images of things like garments, because to see someone in garments would be like, oh, that's overstepping some line. It's actually on your body and it becomes, sexualized.
See, I don't think that it's sexualized.
Disagree?
Yeah. I don't think, I agree with what you're saying, but not that it's sexualized. I think that it's more to that, we've made a covenant that these things are sacred, and sacred doesn't mean secret, but yeah, it kind of does mean secret. And so we're going to keep it secret. I mean, sacred, and not show it to other people embodied, because, there is like this really classic, I don't know if classic's the right word, but picture that I found Googling garments. That's just like a man and a woman. You don't even see their faces. You just see like their bodies. And that the first time I saw that was so shocking to me, because it was blasphemy. It was sacrilegious. So to me, it wasn't like it sexualized them in any way. But it was definitely, this person has gone past the line. They're making the devil happy. They're not making God happy. God's going to be pissed at them for doing this. And, I went through the temple after the penalties had been abolished. So I never experienced that penalty part, but there's still something about that hangs over the temple ceremony, that, these things are not to be shared with anyone outside the temple. And that extends to the embodiment of the vestments.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. That's interesting. I like that idea. That's fascinating.
Thanks.
I can totally see it that way. I think the second part of that's fascinating is this idea of internal versus external. And I think the fact that Mormon vestments are internal and hidden speaks to what we talked about earlier, that we want to be just like everyone else. Like, we want to be the CEO and the presidential candidate.
On the outside.
We want to be just like on the outside, just like everyone else. But little do they know, we're peculiar.
On the
we're
inside.
Different. Right. Yeah. And I think that, if you looked at the beginning of that video and it showed all of these other religions, ours is really the only vestment that is completely internal, mm-hmm. right? That's hidden. And I think that that says a lot about us.
And that's how you can be in the world, but not of the world, right? Where you've got this outside face that looks like everybody else. You blend in, but inside we know that we're different, special. Many called, few chosen. That's us. And we're done.
Hi, this is Karen from the United Arab Emirates. That's in the Middle East. And I am a light set on a hill in the midst of my Muslim brothers and sisters. At least that's what they tell me at church. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.